It was in and among the grey sandstones that the true wealth of the Mearns collieries and all the neighbouring mines was held. For these sandstones were the coal measures, and in them, as Smith was to see as the mine chain clanked him lower still, were, thin, distorted, and plunging deep below, the precious veins of coal. The miners, tough and taciturn men, had given names to all the seams, as miners all around the world always do. Coal seams may all look the same, much as all coal may look alike, but in fact all seams are as different as all people, when they're looked at as closely as a miner has to look. Each band has an internal pattern, a collection of fossil types, an appearance, a feel, a personality, if you will, that makes it instantly recognisable. A miner will be lowered down the shaft and step out into the blackness and know in an instant where he is, how deep in a series, how far down within a seam. Some of the less romantic workers gave their seams mere numbers, Newbury number 2, perhaps, or simply number 7 or number 11. Others were named for obvious reasons, the Great Course, the Little Course, the Standing Coal, the Main Coal, the 9-inch, the Coking Coal. And then there were the seams with stranger names, no longer easily explicable, the Sliving, the Dungy Drift, the Globe, the Perrink, and the Kingswood Toad. "Go work on the Sliving today," might be the order of the morning. "Try your luck with the Perrink, or climb down into the 9-inch if it's not too wet afoot." The men who first found those seams and named them, after their favourite pub perhaps, or a girlfriend, or a hill immediately above the mine, are long dead now, and such histories as have been written of the coalfield give the Mearns Pit, one of the lesser collieries in commercial terms, short shrift indeed. But when the last truckload of coking coal left the last mine in Radstock for the Portishead power station in 1973, it was from one of the deep seams of the field, 9,000 linear feet in absolute terms, below the red earth that lay serenely and unconformably above the contortions of the coal. The stratigraphical order in which the different types of rock were arranged in the coalfield, as the local miners knew and as William Smith learned from them all too rapidly, had an utterly predictable regularity to it. Smith would see and come to know the strata intimately as he saw them one by one, again and again, as the great winding chain lowered him still further down through the measures. First, there would be the sandstones themselves, with strange patterns of bedding about them. Some patterns were large and reminiscent of dunes. Others were small, like the ripples to be found on the beds of river estuaries. Then, after a few dozen feet, the sandstones would peter out and be gradually replaced by argillaceous beds of more thinly bedded rocks, with finer, darker grains, muddy and silty, solidified versions of what one might find on the bed of a shallow river. Next, there would be a bed with fragments of shells, recognisable as the kind of bivalves, carbonicula, and anthracosia among them, that are found in rivers and which abhor the dissolved salts of the sea. Then there would be mudstones, softer, dark, friable rocks, suggestive of, well, solidified mud. Next, an indicative precursor of what would come below, there would invariably be a thin band of lighter-coloured, harder rock, stuffed with shells of a saltwater brachiopod like Lingula, a creature still to be found more or less unaltered today, which lives today as Carboniferous Lingula did 290 million years ago, happily and resolutely among the salt and the wavelets on the seashore. And then below that, the coal. The seam might be the Globe or the Perrink or the Kingswood Toad, and whether it was 9 inches or 9 feet thick, it would always be overlain by the same fasces and underlain by the same seat earth. However, and most important for the ever-observant William Smith, each seam would be subtly different. It might be coloured richly and deeply black. It might be oily, flammable, stiff with flies and footprints, and the relics of eminently burnable fossil vegetation, Mariopteris, Annularia, Lepidodendron, and then suddenly, cut off in a matter of fractions of an inch, the whole black band would be underlain by a light band of non-flammable seat earth, in which once all the ferns, trees and horsetails placed their roots and from which they had gained their sustenance. The pattern Smith saw was always the same in mine after mine after mine, from top to bottom, sandstone, siltstone, mudstone, non-marine band, marine band, coal, seat earth, and then again sandstone, siltstone, mudstone, on and on. On top of everything, placid and unconformable, the red marls, the flatly sloping beds of the startlingly red, red earth. And through all of this, in mine after mine, in quarry after quarry, what was perhaps the most crucial realization of all in this time of early primitive discovery, the fact that recognizable seams of coal would always be in the same position compared to one another. The Dungey Drift, identifiable by its thickness, its color, and its fauna and flora, was always above the Perink. The Rudge was always above the Temple Cloud. Never once, unless the Variscan folding had turned the whole bedding upside down, and a skilled observer could always tell if a rock bed was the right way up or not, would the Sliving be anywhere other than above the Great Course and the Firestone, and it would always be well below the Withy Mills seam and what the miners had christened the Pensford 40-yard. And that, in essence, is what William Smith first learned, both from the miners whom he met and from the sections of the underworld that he saw. He understood for the first time that geology was a science requiring observations in three dimensions. He could make maps and make surveys of the visible upper dimensions of the landscape with ease. Anyone with a modicum of skill could do that. But to see below the surface, to observe or extrapolate the imaginable third dimension underground, that was a new skill, possessed by very few, and yet that had a potential that Smith was soon going to recognize and exploit. But first, he had to grasp and set down on paper the importance of what he had just seen. He pondered on what he remembered. He pored over his notes. And he promptly wrote down in his diary what it was that he realized, and that to judge from what he had seen at all these pits around his farm at Rugbourne, he could make a firm pronouncement about the nature of sedimentary rocks, a pronouncement that he suspected had never been made before. In his opinion, he wrote, all the rocks that had been laid down as sediments at a particular time, in a particular place, are laid down in a way that has much the same characteristics, and most particularly just the same fossils, and always appear in the same vertical order, in the same stratigraphical order, no matter where they are found. He clarified his theory with examples. The coal measures in the south of the Somerset coalfield, near Radstock, for example, display a specific order. There's a sandstone, a siltstone, a mudstone with carbonicula, another siltstone with lingula, then the 4 feet of the Temple Cloud coal seam, then back to sandstone and siltstone, and then the Newbury No. 2 seam and the Globe seam. Using Smith's new theory, it would be possible, by noting the types of fossils he found, to forecast and then to confirm that 10 miles to the north at High Littleton there would be exactly the same order. The Temple Cloud coal with its fossils would be lying above the Newbury No. 2, with its slightly different ferns and fossil leaves, and the Globe, with its peculiar collection of once-dead inhabitants, would be down at the base. In between would be just the same sandstones and mudstones, just the same carboniculi and linguli as back at Radstock. Perhaps not the same thickness, but always, always in the same order. Never, if the beds were lying right side up, would the Globe be at the top. Never would the lingula be found above the carbonicula. Such an order of strata would be repeated also in other places that had never yet been explored. The order would be repeated also in mines yet undug. It was an order that could be well and accurately predicted. The fossils would be the key to working out what the order was. Using them, one could forecast the precise succession of the beds underground, and if they could be forecast, they could and would eventually be mapped. This was true for the coal mines of High Littleton. Of that much, William Smith was now certain. Yet at the same time as he was realizing and understanding all of this, Smith began to wonder. If what he had found was true for the seams, facies, and lithologies of all the rocks that he and the miners had found lying below the red earth, might it not also be true for all the rocks, for the limestones, oolites, shales, clays, cherts, marls, sandstones and silts that lay above it? And might it not be equally true, too, for rocks so far unfound, and which would presumably lie well underneath the coal? Was not this predictability of strata likely to be, in other words, a universal phenomenon? The miners said no. Smith records their instant rejection of his theory matter-of-factly. The order of superposition in the coal measures at each pit seemed well enough known to the colliers, he wrote in his diary, and on drawing a section thereof with 9 veins of coal, I was naturally led to ask whether the superincumbent strata, rising into hills 200 to 300 feet above the mouths of their coal pits, were not also regular. I was told there was nothing regular above the red ground, which in their sinkings varied much in thickness. This did not deter me from pursuing my own thoughts about this subject. It was just as well that he was not deterred. He thought about the miners a little more closely. He felt he could understand why, out of a mixture of protection and plain ignorance, a miner might insist that these particular patterns and fingerprints of rock successions that Smith had recognized were confined to their own rocks, to the coal measures of the upper Carboniferous, and would not be reproducible elsewhere. He might understand the miners' motives, but what they said made no sense at all. Wasn't it more likely that some similarly arranged succession of strata was actually to be found among all the rocks of England, whether they were above or below the coal, whether they were younger or older than it? And further, wasn't it likely, if this orderliness of succession proved true elsewhere, that someone with a good eye and a good imagination could find the arrangements and the possibilities for identifying and following unseen strata, the hidden underground strata, among all the rocks of the world? Might there not thus be some way of predicting what lay where, how deep it lay, how thick the beds were likely to be, and what might lie above and below it? And thus, might there not be a way of drawing a guide to this hitherto hidden underneath of the planet, in much the same way as one drew guides to the visible world, to the simple topography of the overburden? Had he not, in thinking so, stumbled onto an original, fundamental truth? Wasn't it likely that everything he had reasoned for the rocks at High Littleton was true for everywhere else as well? And if it was, then wasn't it likely that everything geological everywhere, whether it was underground or overground, whether it was deep or shallow, whether it was visible or not, could be predicted, could be drawn, and could thus be mapped? New observations were needed. More data, more facts, more work, below and beyond the very special world of the coal mines, beyond the age-limiting, fossil-limiting, lithology-limiting purlieus of the Carboniferous. William Smith needed a bigger canvas on which to sketch the first portrait of what he was now nervously beginning to imagine. And it was then, thanks to connections, location, and coincidence, that William Smith stumbled onto the chance that made him. The coal from Somerset's dozens of mines needed to be moved. The perfidious Welsh across the Avon, having caught the Duke of Bridgewater's fierce mania, were reported to be building a canal and getting ready to move their coal along it. And suddenly, all Somerset was fretful, its miners and mine owners concerned that the county might lose out to Wales, that its coal would never get to the markets. A great Somerset canal urgently needed to be built. William Smith, who was by now an established master of all the local mysteries of coal, a clear and present friend to the local landed mine owners, and known to be clever with the theodolite, the plane table and the chain, was the ideal man to be involved. He knew how to carry out a survey. He was obviously the man to plan the route, to make sure the canal snaked properly from coalfield to market. William Smith, it was decided, should be the Somerset Coal Canal's first surveyor. He accepted the job with almost unseemly relish. He had a motive that he never vouchsafed to his new employers. Not only were the wages excellent, the perks more than acceptable, and the possibilities of share options in the new canal tempting, but the process of building a canal meant that, quite simply, a great swathe of the country needed to be sliced open, cut neatly and deliberately in half. And in the process of cutting the land, Smith might be able, he thought, to confirm his theories, to see if that original and fundamental truth of his was indeed a truth at all. By slicing open this vast line of survey and then building a deep canal halfway across the county, the land itself would for the first time be exposed. It would be laid bare and fresh for Smith to see, to examine in detail, and to wonder if he might, just might, be right. Right in thinking, that is, that one could tell which strata were which by their nature and by their enclosed fossils. If one could do that, one could, in theory, find and identify the outcrop of a particular stratum in one place, and then find and identify it in another place, and another, and before long be able to draw a map, from which it would then be possible to extrapolate, with accuracy and speed, the position of that stratum as it snaked through the entire English underworld. One could do it for one stratum, or, with patience, for all strata. One could then draw a map of the underneath of England just as readily as one could map the overground, and if it might be possible to map the underneath of England, then by extension one could make a map of the hidden underside of the whole wide world beyond. It all depended, though, on his making one so far unmade discovery. He needed to find that the aspects of rocks that were so recognisable within the patterns of the coal measures occurred just as well in the rocks that lay above them. The miners were sceptical, but William Smith was not. He believed that there would be a pattern out there. He needed simply to lay open a great slice of English countryside and see for himself, first-hand. The new canal would be his one opportunity for doing so. The Slicing of Somerset. The British have an unrequited love affair with their railways. The older, the more obscure, the smokier, the more inefficient and less commercially successful they are, the better. Dr. Richard Beeching, whose infamous 1965 report resulted in the closure of 5,000 miles of old, inefficient, but much-loved track and the attendant 2,000 railway stations, most of them wrongly remembered as cottage-like and fret-worked, with endlessly congenial station masters and rosebeds planted on the platforms, is still regarded as a villain. The evidence of Beeching's savagery, abandoned lines now swathed in grass, old bridges rising over emptiness, stations now turned into houses or small factories or left to rot, remains everywhere. And whole communities in remote and pretty parts of Dorset, Cumberland, Norfolk and Yorkshire curse him yet as the man who ruined for ever an enchanting and supremely British way of life along the country railway. The Camerton and Limpley Stoke Railway in North Somerset was as pretty a railway as they come. It was known by local schoolboys, and for obvious onomatopoeic reasons, as the Clank. Its economics, however, made no sense at all, right from the moment it opened for business in 1907. Its tiny income, from a dwindling number of coal mines, from a mill that packaged wool dust, and from the carrying of luggage to and from a boys' private school, doomed it to extinction even before Lord Beeching had the opportunity of getting his hands on its 7 miles and 78 chains of track. The last fare-paying passenger travelled on the morning after Valentine's Day in 1951. But the Clank was memorialised in the minds of many millions of Britons of my generation because it starred, though unrecognised by most who saw it, in one of the most successful British films of the time. It was called The Titfield Thunderbolt, and it was a comedy made in 1952. It told the story of a line that was due for closure, but might be awarded a reprieve if it could show that it could be run, by the villagers who depended on it, with greater efficiency than a competing local bus service. The train was run by a team that included the vicar, the local squire, and the ladies of the Women's Institute. The bus, by contrast, was owned by a pair of curmudgeonly and profiteering blackguards from a grim slum town nearby. Who won and who lost I'll leave for those who have not yet seen the film, but for this account of William Smith's life, the story of the film is less important than the setting in which it was made. For the Titfield Thunderbolt was filmed in the valleys of the Cam and Midford Brooks, at the eastern end of the Camerton and Limpley Stoke Railway, in countryside that was, and still is, as lovely and as unmistakably English as any landscape imaginable. The film seemed then, and still seems, in its time-warped look today, to be set in the middle of some kind of utterly English Elysian fields, where all is sun and lush meadows, babbling brooks and thatched cottages, village greens and cricket matches. On all sides there are comfortable pubs and ample barmaids. The people are by and large sturdy and honourable. The soundtrack drips with a fine nostalgia. There's bird song, and there are steam whistles. We hear a milk churn being loaded, the flap of a porter's flag, distant peals of church bells, the lowing of dairy-ready cattle, and behind it all, as bass continuo, the amiable chuff of steam engines as they amble through cuttings and over level crossings and bustle back down the valleys to their sidings and their home. But this is no fantasy of imagined Englishness. The railway may have gone, but the world in which the Thunderbolt used to run is still there today, south of Bath. It's been preserved in some kind of betjemanesque amber, a patchwork of landscape 6 miles long by 3 miles deep, between the River Avon in the east and the village of Coombe Hay, halfway westwards along the long-disused railway line. But its beauty peters out very quickly and with sudden drama. To the west of Coombe Hay, the land becomes much less interesting, less pretty. A passer-by in the train, where it's still running, would, if travelling westbound, notice the change most easily, would see how the rural idyll between Limpley and Coombe becomes slowly more tinged and tainted by the first indication of industry, of smoke, grit, iron and rust. By the time the engine reaches Dunkerton, a couple of miles on, so the smell of coal dust hangs in the air, and by the next station, Dunkerton Colliery Halt, there is, or was, it's long been demolished, the winding gear of a mine. And then, from there to the west, all is coal, all is industry, all is grim. It takes a small effort of imagination to recall that only 10 miles back down the line, back to the east of Coombe Hay, there was a pretty landscape, landscape of a loveliness from almost another world. The reason, as so often, is the geology. The hills around Coombe Hay and Midford Holt, by Midford and Limpley Stoke itself, are the outcrops of what is called Bath Stone, a warm, honey-coloured oolitic limestone of the Middle Jurassic. A reporter for the Somerset Guardian newspaper understood this well when, in May 1910, he wrote of a railway journey that there is not a more prettily situated line in the locality of Bath. The run through the oolite from Coombe Hay to Monkton Coombe is the most interesting part of the track, because the traveller has lovely views all the time. The oolitic limestone dips gently eastward, much as did the red marls that Smith found in the Mearns Colliery. What this meant to a traveller heading west on the Camerton and Limpley Stoke line, the map shows it passing in an almost direct westerly direction for most of its route towards the terminus at Camerton and the junction at Hallertrow, is that he or she would pass, or chuff, or clank, steadily downwards through the geological table because of the steady dip of the rocks. From the start at Limpley Stoke Station, he or she would pass much of the way through the Jurassic from middle to lower. Somewhere around Coombe Hay Halt, he or she might have noticed having entered the outcrop of Triassic rocks. By the time the train has reached Dunkerton Colliery, the traveller will be in the thick of the Upper Carboniferous and of the coal. This much we know today, and a great deal more besides. In William Smith's time, however, very little was known, and anyone who made that westbound journey from Limpley Stoke to Camerton in 1792 might well have marvelled at the change of scenery, but would have had precious little understanding of which rock was which type might be older or younger than any other, and which appeared where, when it did, and why. Anyone, that is, except for William Smith. For 7 seminal years, these few square miles of gently graduated English loveliness were to become Smith's stamping ground. He worked in precisely the area along which the Camerton and Limpley Stoke Railway ran for the 44 years of its commercial existence. He did so because, 120 years before the railway was built, he was to become, after only the briefest of apprenticeships, the man responsible for surveying the canal, a canal that would provide ready-made the route that the railway itself would later take. As it happened, the railway was built to compete with and ultimately replace and ruin the old canal. But here this matters little. What is important for an understanding of Smith's work is the decisions that were taken by him as to the canal's initial route. Both the canal and the later railway had perforce to start at the same place, Limpley Stoke, because that was the junction for the bigger canal, the Kennet and Avon, along which goods could go to Bristol or to London, and the mainline railway, along which goods could also be taken to the same two industrial centres. Both ended at the same place, Camerton, because that's where the coal was. But the precise route that was taken between these two endpoints was, essentially, up to William Smith to decide. The process of choosing that route was to offer him an intimacy with countryside and landscape that was never to leave him. and it was to set him wondering, too, about all those mysteries that eluded or did not even appear to concern those others who might travel between the two ends of the coal mine route. Why such a journey began in an area of limitless beauty, and why it ended in a region so very much less attractive, would to them be either an enigma or a matter of no consequence. But not to Smith. He was different. His view was different. He alone would in time come to recognize that the simple gradation in the rural loveliness of the canal route said something well worth knowing about Somerset's mysterious underworld. His genius, the unanticipated genius of this uneducated blacksmith's son, was that he realized it was not simply a matter of noticing the difference. It was also possible, desirable, and perhaps important, to find out just why there was a difference in the first place. His survey of the canal was the means to such a discovery. In a sense, the fact that he was making a new canal became eventually almost incidental to his own self-allotted main task, which was to find out why the landscape was the way it appeared to be, and whether any of the lessons he had learned in the coal mines, and which the miners insisted belonged to the mines alone, could apply out in the wider geological world as well. The red marls of the High Lyttelton mines dipped east. The oolite and the Triassic rocks of the canal route dipped east. So could any firm prediction that he made about the one be equally applied to the other? Smith thought so, and the survey would confirm or not, as the case might be. In making the route for the new canal, he would be digging his way through the very rocks that made the hills, lovely but unproductive hills in the east, their aesthetically unremarkable but richly endowed equivalents in the west, that stood in the way of himself, or the canal, and of progress. If only what he found would ultimately confirm what he had suspected from his explorations in the shafts at the Mearns Colliery in High Lyttelton, then his work for the newly formed and comfortably subscribed Somerset Coal Canal Company Limited was likely to be of earth-changing importance. Smith knew that if he cracked the code he suspected he might find during his surveys, then in time he could become a famous man. For William Smith was now a changed and a changing figure. Until he moved down from Gloucestershire to Somerset, he was a man of seemingly modest vision. The small epiphany that occurred during his stay in High Lyttelton showed him the advantages of ambition. Once he had started to work for the Canal Company, that new ambition was to be annealed and case-hardened, until Smith became convinced that he would one day, and with good reason, enjoy a place in history. He needed a brief period of apprenticeship. By good fortune, the renowned Scotsman John Rennie, a towering figure of the day, a man who specialized in making the massive, in building lasting structures like dockyards, bridges, tunnels, breakwaters, and lighthouses, was working nearby. Rennie had evidently heard talk in the local inns of the parliamentary petition for a new small canal in Somerset, and, always eager for new commissions and fresh work, he signed up to make the initial survey for the route of what was at first to be called the Dunkerton and Radstock Canal. But he was too busy to work alone, and he needed help. Two members of the Somerset Canal Committee, to whom Lady Jones had enthused about William Smith's acuity and intelligence, suggested his name. Rennie agreed to meet Smith, and liked him immediately. The great engineer hired the young surveyor on the spot. It was a moment that changed Smith's life forever, particularly since Rennie's own idea was that, if all worked out well, Smith himself would in short order take on the job of surveyor and engineer for the entire canal project. And this is precisely what happened. He got the full-time job and embarked on an association with the Somerset Coal Canal that remains central to his reputation to this day. Seek out any local enthusiast who can still discern the old ruined waterway snaking along its forgotten route through the hayfields. Smith built that, they'd say, you know. Great man. The young man threw himself into his job with great enthusiasm. Not only did his new responsibilities allow him to rub shoulders with such notables as John Rennie and another acclaimed canal builder who was also working nearby, William Jessop, not only did it allow him to explore a particularly lovely piece of the English countryside, not only did it give him an opportunity for both the advancement of a budding career and to take part in the creation of a monument, it allowed him also, and at last, to test his grand ideas. Armed with his theodolite and his chain, his trenching tools and his shovels, Smith thus began the long process of slicing through Somerset. Each day he'd venture out from Rugbourne on his horse, making his way slowly and methodically a few hundred yards each day, from the mines of Camerton eastwards towards the thatch of Limpley Stoke. He'd set up his theodolite and his marker pole and his compass and his chain. He'd measure out a section, he'd write his notes about what he found, and would speculate on the projected ease or difficulty of digging a canal along the path he had chosen, and then he'd pack up all his kit, and piling it onto the back of his long-suffering nag, would move forward another few hundred feet and begin it all again. Unwittingly, he managed to create, in his design for the route of the canal, a device that would help him enormously in his geological inquiries. He and his colleague engineers decided that for most of the route west of Midford, there should actually be two near-parallel canals. There should be a northerly route, the Dunkerton line, and a more southerly, the Radstock line. By this arrangement of double-branching the canal, the coals from the entire coalfield could be collected with a minimum of effort and funnelled eastwards towards the junction with the Kennet and Avon Canal, just by the huge aqueduct at Dundas. The arrangement made good sense from the coal baron's point of view. It also made good forensic sense for William Smith, for it meant that whatever observations he might make in one branch of the canal, he could check in another branch that ran only a mile or so away, in an almost precisely parallel direction. He'd always wanted Somerset to be sliced open. Now it was being sliced and filleted twice over, and all of his work could be compared, checked, and confirmed. It was as he worked patiently forward in this fashion that he first noticed something. He was surveying a stretch of the proposed northern route between Dunkerton and Midford when he saw exactly what he had been hoping for. He observed a variation of the strata on the same line of level, and found that the Lias Rock, which about 3 miles back was a full 300 feet above this line, was now 30 feet below it, and became the bed of a river, and did not appear any more at the surface, he wrote. This induced me to note the inclination of the same rock, which I knew was to be found at the head of two other valleys, lying each about a mile distant from, and in a parallel direction to the one just described, and accordingly found it to dip to the southeast and sink under the rivers in a similar manner. From this I began to consider that other strata might also have the same general inclination as well as this. By tracing them through the country some miles, I found the inclination of every bed to be nearly the same as the Lias. And notwithstanding the partial and local dips of many quarries which varied from this rule, I was thoroughly satisfied by these observations that everything had a general tendency to the southeast, and that there could be none of these beds to the northwest. This, it can be argued, was Smith's most momentous early realization. It was an utterly simple observation that when going from Camerton to Limpley Stoke southeastward, along a line that was both continuously straight in direction and consistently horizontal in attitude, the old rocks that he had been accustomed to seeing in Dunkerton fell away and then vanished beneath his feet, while as he approached Midford, newer and newer rocks appeared in the cliffs and cuttings before him, only to fall away and vanish and be replaced in their turn. These layers of rock, he said, were arranged to resemble, on a large scale, the ordinary appearance of superposed slices of bread and butter. He took notes, and he drew sketches, none of them too clear today, none of them too confident. Those who look at his drawings fancy that they see narrow shaded bands that they imagine mark the outcrop of the coal measures and their unconformable relationship with the Triassic rocks above, and one would-be biographer thinks this might fairly be called the first true geological map. But it isn't, not really, and all one can truly say of the cartography Smith did during his canal days was that he was most definitely thinking about it. He began, he wrote in his diary, to delineate on maps the courses of the strata, and constantly traced and retraced the order in which they'd be intersected in making the canal. His greatest achievement at this stage was not that he drew any maps, that would all come later, but that he noticed things, drew conclusions, and laid plans. He became uncannily able to perceive the spatial geometry of the world beneath his feet, to imagine, on the basis of what he saw above ground, just what the world looked like underneath. Today, some critics remark sniffily that all this came too easily. The Smith was merely lucky, in that his chosen layers of rock all had a uniform dip to them, and they varied along their outcrop in interesting and obvious ways. He could with no difficulty recognise how the limestone turned to clay and then to shale, to oolite and so on, and so the layers revealed themselves to him quite plainly. Some also say that other surveyors had noticed much the same thing many years before Smith did. An amateur member of the local gentry named John Strachey, it's argued, who worked in much the same part of the world, spoke of the layers of rock looking like the leaves of a paper book. Some also point out, quite fairly, that Smith came at first to some naively rash conclusions about the easterly dip of the rocks he examined. It occurred to him, for instance, that since the oolites and the lias and the trias and the chalk of southwestern England had this convenient attitude, then probably all the rocks in the world were arranged likewise. The strata, he wrote, form a set of lines extending from pole to pole with a regular inclination to the east, and the motion of the earth, which probably commenced while these strata were in a soft state or of a pulpy consistency, would naturally place them in an inclined curvilineal position. He realized before long that he had misjudged this badly, and he made a host of other errors besides, with which his critics make hay. But William Smith was the one man who took his observations and formulated his idea and wove the whole cloth of new theory from it. Maybe the local geology did make his task relatively easy. Maybe he wasn't the first to notice the arrangement of the local rocks. But he saw the rocks. He made a deduction. And he then took that deduction to its logical and, as we shall see, its astonishingly beautiful conclusion. After 6 months of heavy labour in the river valleys south of Bath, with the initial survey almost done, Smith's employers suddenly decided he should interrupt his work and take part in a brief expedition. Before the first sod was dug and the first layer of stone laid, matters that were in any case the business of engineers, not surveyors, Smith was to go off on tour and take an instructive look at how other people were routing and then building their canals. So in the late summer of 1794, along with two members of the canal committee, Sanborn Palmer and Dr. Richard Perkins, William Smith was instructed to set out in a postchaise on a journey that would last 2 months and would take him on an expedition over more than 900 miles of England and Wales. He now knew that the collier's rules for coal and his own ideas from High Littleton applied more generally to the hills and valleys he had surveyed elsewhere in Somerset. Was there any chance that they applied, as he thought they might, to the nation as a whole? In the Rugbourne stable yard, as the postillion saddled up the horses, and Smith clambered up into the cart alongside the driver, while Palmer and Perkins sat in the carriage behind, he must have felt a welling sense of apprehension, of the excitement of his confident certainty. He already knew that he could draw a map of a coal mine. His surveying work showed that he could draw a map of North Somerset. Now, as the horses struck sparks on the coachyard cobblestones, he knew he might soon have the opportunity to do the same for England. The View from York Minster. His excitement and his apprehension were still very much a secret. For the first few days in the coach he vowed to say nothing to his travelling companions. William Smith, all of a sudden, was worried. Earlier in the year he had become gripped by an anxiety that is all too common among discoverers who work alone, an anxiety that must have been even more frequent in times when communication was so restricted. For although he was by now quite confident that his assumptions about the order and regularity of stratification were right, he was frantically concerned in case others might be thinking along the same lines. He had no intention of announcing his ideas to Palmer and Perkins. He would not, in fact, for the moment, disclose his theories to anyone. He was still not wholly certain he was right, and he had no intention of blurting out an unformed set of ideas and thereby making a fool of himself. Nor did he want to claim as his own notions that might rightly belong to others. And yet at the same time he hoped against all hope that he had originated these ideas, that he truly was the first to think of them. Shortly before setting off on the trip, he had managed to dispel at least some of these doubts. The Canal Committee had travelled to London en masse to give evidence before Parliament. A bill was needed before the construction of any canal could begin, and though the questioning tended to be perfunctory, members of Parliament needed to know that all was in order, the money had been raised, the opponents all duly heard, all process duly done. William Smith was a witness and recalled with some awe that, even though he was only 25, he was summoned to the bar of the House, sworn in by bewigged lawyers, and compelled to play a significant part in the democratic proceedings of the time. But aside from a day or so giving testimony, he had little else to do. All his expenses were paid, and he was on salaried commission with precious few duties to perform until sent back to Somerset. So he decided he would go burrowing and scavenging through the libraries and bookstores of the capital, searching for anything that might show him what he feared, that like-minded others were on the case, that in creating the still unchristened science of stratigraphy, he was not entirely alone. We've no firm idea of what he found. There was, however, a lot on offer. We do know he acquired, at about this time, some basic reference books. Plot on Oxfordshire, and again on Staffordshire, John Morton on Northamptonshire, and John Woodward's majestic Catalogue of English Fossils. We know he was assiduous in his searches, and that he came home with a considerable library. Almost certainly he would have come across John Strachey's Observations on the Different Strata of Earths and Minerals, written in 1727, and with the engaging theory that all rocks are spinning when laid down, and so are revealed as outcrops as they solidify their edges like an unrolled sheaf of papers. Maybe he saw John Woodward's other great works, his Natural History of the Earth, published in 1695, which revealed his fascination for spelunci, grottos, and wells, and his unshakable belief that the circumstances of these things in remote countries were very much the same as those of ours here. He would perhaps have gained considerable insight had he found a copy of An Inquiry into the Original State and Formation of the Earth by John Whitehurst, which was popular enough to have had two editions in 1778 and 1786. Though the book put great emphasis on Derbyshire, still one of the English counties most useful to teachers of geology, and so swarming each year with students equipped with magnifying glass, compass, perhaps a now environmentally incorrect bottle of hydrochloric acid, and an Estwing hammer, it laid out a more general programme that Smith himself would follow, almost to the letter. "It is my intention to have deposited specimens of each stratum with its productions in the British Museum, arranged in the same order above each other as they are in the earth, being persuaded that such a plan would convey a more perfect idea of the subterraneous geography and of the various bodies enclosed in the earth than words or lines could possibly express." But we have little clear idea of his reaction to anything he discovered. Would Whitehurst have inspired him right away, or would he have been depressed on reading it, suspecting that he had rivals? Would he have been dejected to read Christopher Pack's 1743 description of the geology of Kent, his so-called philosophico-choreographical chart, since the author insisted that his was a real scheme taken on the spot with patience and diligence, or by The Course and Phenomena of Earthquakes, published in 1760 by the Reverend John Mitchell, who took Strachey's rolled-up papers view of the world and, bending them up together into a ridge in the middle, conceived them to be reduced again to a level surface by a plane so passing through them as to cut off all the part that has been raised. Let the middle now be raised again a little, and this will be a representation of most, if not all, large tracts of mountainous countries. Would he have been dejected by such thoughts and such writings? Intimidated? Apparently not in the slightest. Indeed, he seemed almost smug. Although several authors had noticed the thickness of some strata in succession in various parts of the country, their resemblance to others was never noticed. None were collated, and for want of comparisons there could not be any reasonings on the subject. By the time he had left London and was back at Rugbourne, readying himself to set out for the Bath postchaise terminus, he was displaying remarkable equanimity. No such observations as he had made, he wrote, had ever been placed on record, at least not yet, and not in England. Yet, as the party trotted off northwards from Bath, he still steadfastly kept his own counsel. He was, he would later write, overjoyed to be going on this journey. It would go everywhere he wanted. They would pass northeastward through the English Midlands, up to Leeds and York, along the east coast up to Newcastle-upon-Tyne, where there were no planned canals, none north of Leeds, in fact. Then, after a brief halt in an inn, they'd cross back over the Pennines and head home via Lancashire and Shropshire and the borders with Wales. Perkins and Palmer sat inside the carriage, chatting endlessly about the possibilities for profit. They were interested only in using the tour to find out more about the mining and carrying of coal. Sanborn Palmer was a landowner and suspected his estates contained abundant riches, if only they could be transported to markets swiftly and cheaply. But Smith, though professionally interested in all matters flammable, had grander designs. He sat invariably out in the open, perched beside the driver and his blunderbuss-equipped guard, constantly scanning the horizon, continually asking to be allowed to get down and flail away at some roadside exposure, with the small hammer he always seemed to keep with him, as his nephew was later to write, and to bring specimens of rocks, fossils, crystals and minerals back into the coach with him. "The slow driving up the steep hills," he noted in his diary, "afforded me distinct views of the nature of the rocks, rushy pastures on the slopes of the hills, the rivulets and kinds of trees, all aided in defining the intermediate clays, and while occasionally walking to bridges, locks, and other works on the lines of the canal, more particular observations could be made." Outwardly, he was there for Perkins, Palmer, and the Somerset Canal Company, but the most important of my interests I pursued unknown to them. Though I was continually talking about rocks and other strata, they seemed not desirous of knowing the guiding principles. More than likely the couple thought of him as a fusty old bore, and laughed at him a little from behind their Woodstock gloves. But it has to be remembered, too, that people, especially those older than Smith, and the small army of similarly curious and inventive younger people who were coming to the fore in the England of these times, were likely to be as much perplexed as wearily amused. Their world, that had seemed so stable for so long, was now changing all too rapidly, and men like Palmer and Perkins only half understood what was happening. They might have recognised in their strange companion what some of today's middle-aged recognise in the young electronic visionaries, that Smith was a man who, though part of their world, still had a view that was somehow much larger than theirs, that he had firm sight of a future that he somehow knew was better, as well as being a future that was definably different and, most crucially, utterly unlike the world of the present. William Smith knew that he stood on the edge of something, and that knowledge, that certainty, set him somehow apart and made other, more ordinary men uneasy. They crossed the Cotswolds, put down at Tetbury, and again at the head of the River Thames, and took time, as Smith had already done with Edward Webb, to see the huge canal tunnel at Sapperton, because the initial plans for the coal canal called for a long tunnel to be built near Coombe Hay. They looked at the King's North Tunnel on the Worcester and Birmingham Canal, Palmer remarking disdainfully, according to Smith's diary, that the young surveyor spent an unduly long time inspecting the walls of the tunnels, gazing intently at the rocks through which they had been bored, hammering bits from the sides and taking away fossils and samples until the coach groaned under their weight. They passed on through Derby and Ripley, dropped in to look at the great palace of the Dukes of Devonshire at Chatsworth, went on to Matlock, and at Lord Fitzwilliam's mine at Hisley Wood, Smith and Dr. Perkins were lowered deep into the pit in a basket, suspended, as at High Littleton, from a quintain-like crossbar worked by a steam engine. And then at Leeds, at the outer edge of the Yorkshire coalfield, from which point north there were no more canals, they decided to transmute themselves into tourists, and visit the three cathedral towns of York, Durham and Newcastle, and thereafter call it a day. Some like to say that it was high in the Tower of York Minster that Smith first broke his silence and told his travelling companions about his bold ideas. There's little hard evidence for this, but it makes for a compelling tale, written most recently as fiction, in a remarkable book, The Floating Egg, by a keenly original Yorkshire geologist named Roger Osborne. According to Osborne's account, the three men climb the 290 steps from the nave to the top of the York Minster Tower, Smith bounding ahead, the others panting damply, and having to pause to catch their breath on the transept roof. When finally they reach the top, where there's a view for 30 miles in each direction, they find the young Smith standing transfixed as if in a dream, bright-eyed with obvious excitement, caught in the headlights of a remarkable idea. They ask him what excites him. "You see those hills, Mr. Palmer?"
"I do."
"You may not know it, but it's possible from their contours, the lack of trees, and their general appearance, to say they are made of chalk."
"That is a remarkable skill. I congratulate you."
No, that's not the point."
His impatience with me was perhaps necessary, and I tolerated it.
"It's the pattern that's everything."
"I see," I said, though I confess I did not.
"You remember the canal at King's North and the locks to the north of Birmingham?" He was animated now, as if excited himself by the words he was saying.
"I remember them well."
"The rock they passed through was a kind of red marl and sandstone mixed up."
"I remember you saying so at the time."
"In each case it lay as unconformable cover to the coal measures."
"What exactly does that mean?"
"It lies over them, but there's an interruption between the beds, that's all. Just as at the colliery at High Littleton, and all over Somerset."
"I see."
"And then we came on to the limestone of the Lias in Derbyshire, and here in Yorkshire, just as in the Cotswold Hills."
I must have looked a little confused at this, as Mr. Smith saw the need to explain further.
He grasped my hands and held them flat and horizontal between his. "The rock strata are formed like this, the oldest beneath and the youngest on top."
Yes, I know that much."
I might have been annoyed at him, but his enthusiasm was a pleasant tonic. "Now, everywhere we've been, the rocks have tended to dip like this," he twisted our hands slightly, "towards the southeast."
"I understand."
"So that when the top is levelled off, at the surface of the ground..." Smith slid our hands in their diagonal aspect so that the edges of them made a flat surface. "The oldest rocks are to the northwest, and the youngest to the southeast." We both looked at our hands for a moment or two, then became a little embarrassed and dropped them. Mr. Smith looked out across the country and seemed in danger of re-entering his private world.
"And the chalk, Mr. Smith?"
"Ah, yes, the chalk, Mr. Palmer. The chalk, you see, is the youngest yet. If this pattern is true, if it repeated all over the kingdom, then to the south and east of the Lias limestone and the red sandstone and the coal, there must always be chalk. And there..." He pointed to the eastern horizon again, as if to keep the vision of the hills alive. "As on the downs of Wiltshire and Hampshire, is the chalk, Mr. Palmer."
"Then you are to be congratulated on a notable discovery, Mr. Smith."
The day of that visit to the thousand-year-old Minster goes unrecorded by Palmer, by Perkins, and by the historians of the great church. Smith himself makes the briefest mention. "From the top of York Minster I could see that the wolds contained chalk in their contour," a remark that allows what Roger Osborne suggests to sound more than plausible. It further allows his solid and reliably old-fashioned Mr. Sanborn Palmer to write in his supposed diary that for this reason that unremembered day on the tower of the greatest church in northern England remains the birthday of the science of stratigraphy. We do not know the precise date, but we do know that the event took place, and that with Smith at last revealing his theories to two members of the more general public, the science he had for months been on the brink of creating was now announced, and so now existed. The word stratigraphy was not itself to appear in print for another 70 years, and that in a description of Smith's own work. The word stratigraphical, however, was to appear a good deal sooner, in 1817, in fact, and it did so as the title of a book by Smith, in which he expatiated on the ideas he first conceived in High Littleton, and which possibly, just possibly, he first made public on that cool and windy late summer's day, 200 feet atop the great cathedral in the city of York. And here in the narrative, certain fact takes over once again from supposition. The diaries and the memoirs offer fragments from the journey. The trio made a few more northward miles, with Smith now fully confident of his thesis, and eagerly and loudly proclaiming his observations and thoughts to all who would listen. His diary interweaves, as diaries do, the trivial with the profound. He notes how they dined on pineapples at the Black Swan, but that when they left town next morning, how geologically similar were the Hambleton Hills to the Cotswolds 300 miles back to the southwest, how there were cliffs of the familiar red marl near Thirsk,
how there was a yellow limestone lying unconformably above the coal at Ferry Hill and Pierce Bridge, and yet how in Harrogate, newly opened as a fashionable spa, Dr. Perkins was persuaded to take a nauseous draught of sulphur water as we sat in the chaise. By the end of September, the party was back in Bath, and Smith, invigorated and brimming with ideas, settled himself down to the making of the canal. However, matters didn't turn out exactly as he had hoped. The engineering work turned out to be very trying. His masters proved exacting, and though by the very nature of his work he was suffused with the geology of the region, he found he had no time to think, to assemble the broader picture. What he had hoped would be an intellectually stimulating time, he found to be frustrating. He was obliged, he wrote, to suspend temporarily my much-wished-for opportunity to make an accurate delineation of the stratification throughout England. However, he was able to mitigate what he thought of as his stratigraphical impotence with the pleasures of burgeoning economic success. Within months of coming back from his tour, he left his rooms at Rugbourne Farm and took a lease on the central house in a small and elegant Georgian crescent on the hills just outside and overlooking the city of Bath itself. He was now being paid well, a guinea a day plus travelling expenses, and he had few outgoings and no family to support. He was able to dress as befitted a gentleman of the time and to engage in a modest round of social events, though so far as can be gathered from his diaries, he tended to restrict himself to the gentlemen scientists of the town, the divines and the antiquaries, and the men of odd enthusiasms. He had no eye for art, no ear for music. He was not socially confident enough to venture to the salons and the tea-rooms, and he resisted all temptation to become a fop, a dandy, or a dilettante. He was an engineer, a surveyor, a man of minerals, and as he saw it, of great scientific ideas. He was content simply to work with the canal excavators, who called at his house each day in response to advertisements he had placed in the Bath Chronicle, and to travel with them to superintend the painstaking, inch-by-inch digging of the works. And he was then happy to come home each evening and to gaze from his windows at a prospect that clearly pleased. From this point the eye roved anxiously over the interesting expanse which extended before me to the Sugarloaf Mountain in Monmouthshire, and embraced all the vicinities of Bath and Bristol. Then did a thousand thoughts occur to me respecting the geology of that and the adjacent districts continually under my eye. The city of Bath is, of course, very proud to have had William Smith as a resident, and in 1926 it unveiled a plaque to him. Local worthies explained why the city had so eminently suited him. Of all the countries with which I am acquainted, no one is so interesting to the geologist as the vicinity of Bath, because in no other are so many strata exposed to view, said one. And another, I need not elaborate the physical circumstances which favour the student of geology in Bath. Besides the water supply, hot and cold, the steep cliffs and hillsides with their quarries of building stone, the neighbouring coal measures and the canals, within easy riding distance are outcrops of the stratified rocks from the Silurian to the Upper Cretaceous, those to the east displaying a regular and obvious succession, those to the west disturbed by unconformities and faults. Stimulating and fashionable though the city might be, Smith evidently chafed, either at the daily commute by horseback to the digging sites, or because of a more general longing for the rural life to which he was so accustomed. Within a year of leasing the house in Cottage Crescent, he had taken semi-permanent rooms in the old Swan Inn at Dunkerton, which is right on the route of the canal, and also where the Roman road, the Foss Way, crosses the canal's route, and where the new cuttings revealed a Jurassic passage, the transition from the Lias in the west of the village to the inferior oolite, and the limestones of which all Bath is made. And then, 18 months or so later still, the restless Mr. Smith moved yet again. For £1,600, £300 paid as cash, the rest borrowed on a mortgage that was to have the direst of consequences for him many years down the line, he bought his first ever property, a small and exceptionally pretty estate known as the Tucking Mill. There has been some confusion as to exactly which house it was he bought. The two-storey Tucking Mill cottage, with its unusual Gothic sash windows, that stands on the narrow, leafy road between Midford and Monkton Coombe, and that has a memorial tablet in its front wall saying that Smith once lived there, seems not to be it. Instead, shrouded by trees to the east of this house, is a much plainer and more severe structure, the Tucking Mill House. A tiny brook separates the two properties, and, as it happens, this same brook divides two parishes. The one to the west, where the tableted cottage stands, is the parish of South Stoke, while that with the unmarked plainer house is the parish of Monkton Coombe. And a search of the tax returns shows that it was a property in the Monkton Coombe parish, owned by a Mr. E. Candler, that Smith bought in March 1798. He must, therefore, have owned the house. A little local controversy still simmers, suggesting that the plaque be moved in satisfaction of historical accuracy, if not necessarily in the interests of local real estate prices. In any event, it could hardly be more appropriate than for Smith to live in a tucking mill. Tucking is the old word for fulling, which is the process whereby wool is scoured, beaten, and cleansed of the lanolin grease with which sheep make themselves warm and waterproof. The substance used to wash the raw wool is to be found uniquely in the very Jurassic strata that Smith was slicing through with his canal, a clay found in the Middle Jurassic between the inferior and the great oolites, and known as Fuller's Earth. It is a strange clay-like rock, rich in a hydrous aluminium silicate mineral known as smectite, which happens to have the ability to absorb oil. To live in a house that is named after a process in which geology plays an essential part brings a fine symmetry to William Smith's living condition, and one that almost certainly contributed to his eagerness to buy the house in the first place. Whether it was a wise and prudent decision, he wouldn't know for more than 20 years. Yet, as the 18th century was coming to a close, Smith had at least all the outward trappings of gentlemanly achievement. He had an excellent job, a group of admiring and influential friends, and now at last he had an elegant house with a small lake, a waterfall, and 17 acres of well-laid-out grounds. He was able to use the house as his headquarters, not merely for his work, but to house the collection that was now fast becoming central to all of his activities, and his employment of which is central to the modern memory of him. Tucking Mill House is where William Smith set aside a room and had carpenters build for him glass-fronted cabinets, so that he could house, collate, catalogue, organise and display his growing collection from the rocks around him locally and from his travels far and wide of fossils.